with that reading and a class name of Signs of the Times, I'm very excited to ask Brother Jim to come give his class. Brother Jim.
Well, thank you, Brother Derek, and good evening, brethren and sisters, and young people and friends. For those who know their Bible prophecy, we're living in very exciting times, aren't we? And tonight we're going to see how much is happening, and I think most of you are fully aware that there's a convergence of events. There's a lot of things happening, and they're all coming together to a point, because we know that we're very near the return of our Lord Jesus Christ. So we've taken the words of the hymn, Mark how the signs abound, because they do abound. There's no question about that. Over the last couple of years, we've seen some very rapid changes, of course, in the Middle East. Israel's friendship with Turkey was terminated in June 2010 over the Gaza incident. The Arab Spring, of course, which began around 2.5 years ago, has unseated several Middle East dictatorships, including that very stubborn one of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. He's gone, shot by his own gun, they say, and it's shaken many other dictatorships in that area. Tunisia, Egypt, Libya have fallen to the spirit of democracy. Liberty, equality and fraternity have done their deadly work in those countries. And we know why this is happening, don't we, brothers and sisters? This is not happening by accident. We know from Daniel 4 verse 17 that this matter is by the decree of the watchers, that is, the angels who are sent forth by Christ on behalf of his Father to accomplish Bible prophecy. The demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent, this is why it's done, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men. So it's not for those who are sleeping in the grave. This is for you and me. And when we see these events, we know that our God is at work and we know that he has a purpose and we're confident that it's about to come to pass. So tonight we're going to have a look at many events that are occurring. We're going to see how relevant they are to us. We're going to see that we're a hair's breadth away, I believe, from the return of our Lord Jesus Christ. Well then, Syria is bathed in bloodshed as the Assad regime is trying to hold on to power. Deadly weapons from Libya, now that conflict is over, have been shipped to the Gaza Strip. Israel's pretty concerned about that. Iran, Hezbollah and Hamas, of course, threaten Israeli security, and we know that war is always about to happen. They're depending on the course of events. They're never very far away from some kind of conflict. That's all going to change. It has to change, as we're going to see, according to Bible prophecy. So this land upon which the eyes of Yahweh our God are from the beginning of the year to the end of the year is very near and dear to us, isn't it? Because it's our place of inheritance. This is where we hope to end up, along with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob and all the faithful. Psalm 121 verse 4 says, Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. And Zechariah 2 verse 8, of course, makes the point, For he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. And so Yahweh is supervising the events in the Middle East because of that promise that he made to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, because of that land and because of the people that came from the loins of the fathers. I want to talk just briefly about Israel. I'm going to range across a number of themes tonight, so I apologise if I pass over some of them pretty quickly. I apologise if I talk like a Gatling gun. Well, there is a need to get through this. As you're going to see, there's a lot of stuff before us tonight. Israel, for four decades, or nearly five decades, was led by socialist governments. And that's why Israel's economy, for all of that length of time, was basically a basket case. I mean, socialists don't know how to run economies, do they? They've proven that. History's proven that. And that's why God intervened to do something about Israel's economic sluggishness. Why? Because Bible prophecy requires that prior to Armageddon, Israel is going to be one of the most prosperous nations on earth. Guess what they are today? One of the most prosperous nations on earth. You know how that happened? Well, it happened because of divine intervention. Ezekiel 38 verse 12. You might just want to come to Ezekiel 38 because we're going to focus upon it a little bit tonight. We're going to have a look at what it requires. Ezekiel 38 makes this point in verse 12, doesn't it? When it says that Gog comes down upon a very prosperous land, it says there in verse 12, You come to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn your hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, that are flourishing with all kinds of agriculture, which are then spelled out for us in the balance of that verse. So Israel has to be prosperous prior to Armageddon, and we're well on the way to that being fully achieved. God's arrangement was to put in power a man called Benjamin Netanyahu, American-educated MBA. He knows a bit about business. He comes from a country that knows a little bit about business. He was educated, of course, here, and he became Prime Minister of Israel from 1996 through to 1999, and, of course, from 2009 to the present. He reformed Israel's financial system when Ariel Sharon made him Israel's finance minister in 2003. You know, if you want to put down your opposition for power, and that's what Ariel Sharon was doing, you hand him the poisoned chalice of the finance ministry. That's the way to put down your opposition, you see. Well, Netanyahu took it with both hands and made a really good job of it. You know what he did? I'm not boasting in this. You know what he did, one of the first things he did? He introduced legislation into the Knesset to have banking regulations and business regulations based on the Australian and the Canadian model. I'm sorry, US, but it was the Australian and Canadian model. You know who came through the banking crisis of 2007, 8 and 9 the best? We're going to point that out later. Australia and Canada and New Zealand, those countries who've got that model. All right? So that is why he introduced, not because of the experience, but because he knew it was a good model and he knew it would work. And it has worked. Israel prospers today in many and varied fields. They lead the world in computer technology. Sorry, Silicon Valley, left behind. Israel and India, leading the world in computer technology. Agriculture, you know, if you have a system to water your lawn or your plants, it probably comes from Israel. It was invented to bring water to the desert, you know, to drip feed trees and vegetables in the desert. And they made the desert blossom like a rose. They boast about that. They lead the world in arts, in science, in weapons development. Oil and gas pretty soon, because they've just found huge quantities of it, that they're going to become totally independent. And diamonds. All cut diamonds in the world are cut in the land of Israel. You know that? And we could go on and on. That nation has become very, very prosperous, but they've also become quite arrogant, as we're going to see. And they're becoming isolated. You know, Jeremiah chapter 30, verses 13 and 14 requires that Israel will lose all its lovers. All thy lovers have forgotten thee, it says. And the context is just prior to Armageddon. It's the context of the time of Jacob's trouble. So Israel will lose all of its supporters, including United States of America. So that's what's happening now, isn't it? There's been a turn of events in that direction. Obama's not really what you'd call a classic supporter of Israel, is he? So that's what's happening, brethren and sisters, and it's happening right across the board. Of the 175 United Nations Security Council and the 690 General Assembly resolutions passed before 1990, and that's 23 years ago, 97 of the 175 and 429 of the 690 resolutions passed there were directed against Israel. And Israel is a member of that community. That just gives you an idea of what the nations think about this nation of Israel. And prophecy is going to be fulfilled. They will lose all of their friends and they won't care, as you're going to see in a moment. Both the US and Britain have shifted their attitude towards Israel recently, and sadly I can say the same from the country that I come from. The Australian government has also changed its attitude marginally towards Israel. The once close ally Turkey to the north is no longer an ally, and they've led the boycott of nations over the Gaza fiasco, in which, of course, they lost 9 of their citizens. We're not very far from Ezekiel 39. Just turn the page to Ezekiel 39 and verse 24. Maybe just verse 23. This is what God says. This chapter is about the work of Elijah, the recovery of all the Jews, and there are 14 million Jews in the world today. And many of those, of course, are outside the land of Israel because their population is 5.7 million. So there's a lot of Jews outside the land of Israel. Elijah's work is going to be, of course, in the second Exodus to bring them back, to purge the rebels from among them. This is what God says about that work in verse 23. He says, "The nations shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they trespassed against me. Therefore hid I my face from them." You know, three times that's stated here, brethren and sisters. You find that phrase again at the end of verse 24. He says, "I hid my face from them." You find it again in verse 29. "Neither will I hide my face any more from them." Because when he's recovered them, he won't need to hide his face anymore. But God says he's hidden his face from this people for a long time. And you know what? The worst period of their transgressions against him is still yet to come. Let's read verses 25 and 26. "Therefore thus saith Adonai Yahweh, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel and will be jealous for my holy name. After that they have borne their shame and all their trespasses whereby they have trespassed against me." When? That's the most important word in the verse. "When they dwelt safely in their land and none made them afraid." When was that? Well, it's not now. Israel's got 26,000 Hezbollah rockets pointing at them that can reach the Gaza. They got the Hamas firing rockets across the border. They got Syria, of course, which is a time bomb. They got Iran saying they should be wiped off the map. Do they feel safe today? Are they living in security? No, I've just been there. There's a huge 8-metre wall, 9-metre wall that goes around the West Bank. Takes you hours to get through. They're not safe today. But you see, when you read Ezekiel 38, verse 8, it says this. Ezekiel 38, verse 8, towards the end says, "And they shall dwell safely, all of them." Have a look at verse 11. "Thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely or securely. All of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates." That's the situation prior to Armageddon. And we're a long way from that, or it seems we're a long way from that. We're not, in fact, very far from that at all, as I'm going to explain to you tonight. But that's not Israel's situation today, is it? They're not secure today. So you know what this passage in Ezekiel 39 is telling us? It's telling us, and they've got a long history of upsetting their God, it's telling us that it's the 10 years prior to Armageddon. From the time that the saints are taken away to the judgment, 10 years that follow, prior to Armageddon, that's the period in which they upset their God the most. I want to show you why. Because they will become totally arrogant. They will become very, very wealthy and confident in their own strength. You know that Israel today actually calls itself its own Messiah? They believe that the nation is the Messiah. I could, if I had time, I could prove that to you. But that's what they have, their confidence in themselves. That latter-day arrogance is spelled out in this passage here in Ezekiel 39. It peaks in the latter days. And recent massive finds of oil and gas will make Israel self-sufficient for decades. And they can thumb their nose at the Americans. They don't need American money anymore. That's what's happening. Israel attributes its success to its own ingenuity and endurance under duress, oppression, and attack by its enemies. You know, many of the Holocaust generation ceased to believe in God. Their fathers in the concentration camps of Germany and elsewhere cried out to God for deliverance. And they cried unto him day after day. You know, it's exactly what Deuteronomy 28 said they would do. Would God that it were morning. Would God that it were evening. They were crying. And he did not answer. So they decided that there was no God. There must be no God. And these were the people in the main who came back to the land. It is a fact, and this has come from a Jewish rabbi himself, an American Jewish rabbi. It is a fact that the religious Jews were opposed to the state of Israel. Their argument was, leave it to God. It was the atheistic Jews who established the state of Israel. And that's why they're like they are. And that's why they had this arrogance. And that's why there needs to be the events of Armageddon to humble the people in that land. Now listen to this.
States surrounded by Arab countries 650 times its size, some of which are large bases of global terror. Only 44 miles separate between the Jordan Valley and the Mediterranean Sea. After the Six-Day War in 1967, when Israel was attacked by four armies on three fronts, United Nations Security Council Resolution 242 stated that Israel was entitled to new defensible borders to replace the previous fragile lines from which it was attacked. What are Israel's defensible borders? What are its essential security needs? The Jordan Rift Valley, Israel's eastern frontier, forms a natural barrier between Israel and the countries of Jordan, Iraq, and Iran. The Jordan Valley rises from an area that is 1,200 feet below sea level to a hilly ridge of up to 3,000 feet, creating a steep 4,200-foot virtual wall opposite any force attacking from the east. The growing threat of global jihad activity near Israel's borders requires it to prevent infiltrations of terrorists and weapons. When Israel left the Philadelphia corridor in Gaza, it became a highway for the infiltration of terrorists and the flow of hundreds of tons of ammunition and weaponry from all over the Arab world, aimed at Israeli civilians. The Jordan Valley is the equivalent of Gaza's Philadelphia corridor in the West Bank. To defend itself, Israel must retain control over the Jordan Valley. This is Israel's mountain ridge, rising up to 3,000 feet. It dominates Israel's major coastal cities, where more than 70% of its population, 80% of its industry, and all of its airfields and seaports are located. Israel's only international airport, Ben Gurion, would be in the range of even primitive rockets, while all planes taking off and landing would be threatened by shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles. More advanced weaponry would be able to hit virtually any point in Israel. If Israel were forced back to the 1949 armistice lines, the Green Line, the country's width would be reduced to a narrow 9-mile waistline that would be impossible to defend. That's why any future arrangement must include Israeli control over key areas of the mountain ridge and a demilitarized Palestinian state. There is enormous uncertainty about future trends in the Middle East. Iran is determined to become the supreme power. No one can guarantee the future of many of the current regimes in the region.
Now, the reason I show that, brethren and sisters, is that Israel, that's an Israeli movie. Did you see that they said that Israel must retain control of the Jordan Valley and that if there's a Palestinian state, it must be a demilitarized Palestinian state? They don't read their Bibles very carefully. Ezekiel 38 verse 8 tells us there will not be a Palestinian state on the mountains of Israel. Have a look at verse 8 again of Ezekiel 38. It says this in verse 8. After many days thou shalt be visited, Gog. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many peoples against the mountains of Israel, which have always been waste. So you saw that movie. You saw where the mountains of Israel were. 90% of the mountains of Israel are in what they call the West Bank. God calls it the mountains of Israel. He doesn't call the mountains of Palestine. It's not going to be a Palestinian state. If there is such a thing, it will be down the Gaza Strip. It will not be on the West Bank. Israel is going to secure that territory and annex it at some point and make it part of Israel proper. We can say that with absolute confidence based on Ezekiel 38 verse 8. Well, what does Ezekiel 38 require? It requires, of course, a dictator dominating the Eurasian continent to the north of Israel. It requires the territory east and north of Israel under Gogian control, verses 5 and 6. It requires a dependent Europe falling under Gog's political control, verse 6. It requires the West Bank to be part of Israel proper, verse 8. Israel will be at peace internally and with its near neighbours, verses 8 to 11. Israel will be very prosperous and be envied by other nations, verse 12. Britain will be allied with its former colonies in opposition to Gog, verse 13. And that verse also implies the Arabian Peninsula will support Britain in its opposition to Gog. So they're all the things that are required by Ezekiel 38, and of course there's more, but they're the ones I want to focus on tonight. So let's take them in turn. The rise of a dictatorship to the north of Israel. You know, when Putin came to power, and we know God puts people in power, he sets up over the nations those whom he wants to rule. He put this man in power by some very interesting circumstances, if we had the time to talk about Habakkuk chapter 2. So who is this man who came up through the KGB and became president of Russia in 2000 and now might rule until 2024? You know, he's fiddled with the constitution. He put his puppet in there for a period of time. And when that period was over, he'd got the presidential term out to 6 years instead of four. Now he could rule potentially to 2024. That's quite long enough as far as we're concerned, isn't it? So what have we got? Well, we've got the latter-day dictator of Habakkuk 2, of whom they say, "Woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay." The word in the Hebrew means pledges of allegiance. That's now in existence, brothers and sisters. You know what they've got in Russia now because of this man's activity? They've got what they call the vertical of power. The vertical of power means we've got a czarist system back, where one man sits at the top and makes all the decisions, and he gets the secret police to make sure that his decisions are implemented. And if they're not, well, you disappear. You don't come to a very nice end. That's the way that the czarist system works. That's what Habakkuk 2 talks about. That's what Ezekiel 38 verse 2 talks about. That system is there. Maybe even Gog is there. We don't know who the Gog is. We do know he's a dictator, and we do know that this is the kind of system that has to be there in Russia, and it's there. So this Rosh that we know, of course, that occurs in Ezekiel 38 verse 2 and 3 is a proper name, says Jasenius in his lexicon, of a northern nation mentioned with Tubal and Meshech, undoubtedly the Russians, who are mentioned by Byzantine writers under the name Rus, dwelling, it says, here by the river Var, or Volga, as we call it. And, of course, we know that this is the area in which Putin has come to power. This is the land of Magog, Rosh, prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal. He's of the land of Magog, it says. This is the area. There's the Volga, runs into the Caspian Sea. And, of course, you've got Meshech and Tubal up there. And when you go to Russia today, guess what you see on government vehicles? That's a government license plate. R-U-S. Interesting, isn't it? Called by the name Rus, says Jasenius. We have no doubts about who the Gog is, do we? And it's all because we know that this power that's developing in the north will draw together its massive confederacy from the four points of the compass to come down upon the mountains of Israel, precipitate Armageddon, and that will see the introduction, of course, of the kingdom of God. And by stages over 40 years, that kingdom will be fully established. What about verses 5 to 7 of Ezekiel 38? Persia, Ethiopia and Libya with them. We want to talk a bit about that name Persia in a moment. You know, there's some things you're going to hear tonight that you've heard 1,000 times before. There are some things you might not have heard before, so there will be times when you need to pull on the thinking cap. We're going to try and put this picture together. So who are these powers? Well, we know Ethiopia is modern Sudan. Libya, of course, is the country next to Egypt, just fallen to the spirit of democracy. Goma refers to the Galatians or Gauls who migrated west to France, Holland and Belgium, and we would call those the nations of Western Europe today. Togarmah are the countries north of Israel, particularly Armenia. That's the name of the Torkomatsi, Togarmah, the Armenians. But it's that area of eastern Turkey to the due north of Israel. And we are told that Gog is going to be a guard of a prison. That's what this word guard means in the Hebrew. A guard of a prison. Jasenius says it means a custodian. He's going to lock them up in his prison of political control. We want to talk about how that will happen. It has to happen. But just a brief word, first of all, about Egypt and Libya. The Arab Spring overthrew the Gaddafi regime, and we've seen from Ezekiel 38 that Libya will end up in the Gogian camp. But what about the nation next door, Egypt? Well, that too has fallen to the spirit of democracy. It's become chaotic and ungovernable until it becomes, of course, in its weakened state, a target of Gog, Isaiah 19, verse 4. Could I take you back to Isaiah 19 very briefly? Isaiah 19 is one of those wonderful chapters that speaks about the destiny of a nation, this nation of Egypt. You know, we would take a couple of sessions to work through it. So I'm just going to give you a very brief thumbnail sketch and point out one or two things. Isaiah 19 is about the smiting and the healing of Egypt. And you can read that in verse 22. It says, "And Yahweh shall smite Egypt. He shall smite and heal it. And they shall return even to Yahweh, and he shall be entreated of them and shall heal them." So that's the ultimate objective. Now, Isaiah 19 has an apocalyptic structure, brethren and sisters. It means that you get the final picture up front, and then you get the way that it comes to pass. So verse 1 of Isaiah 19 is about that final objective, when the smiting and healing is done. Have a look at verse 1, it says this. "The burden of Egypt, behold, Yahweh rideth upon a swift cloud." Read Christ and the saints coming into Egypt prior to Armageddon. That's the subject matter, by the way, of other prophecies, including Daniel 11 has got something to say about that. And it says, "And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence." Now that word "moved" there in the Hebrew, nuah, means not just to move, but to remove, to take them away. The idols of Egypt are going to be removed. This is the objective of the smiting and healing of Egypt, a process that will take some 40 years. And you go on to read that the heart of Egypt will melt in the midst of it. And in verse 2 we read, this is how it's all going to come to pass. You'd think you were reading a newspaper. Read verse 2 with me. "And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians." March 2011. "And they shall fight everyone against his brother." There happens to be a movement in Egypt called the Muslim Brotherhood. "And everyone against his neighbour, city against city." I think I recall sometime last year that one city fought against another. They were playing a soccer match. Remember that one? And one city sent its ambassadors to the other city and they butchered people on a soccer ground. Then it says this, "And kingdom against kingdom." The Septuagint says district against district. Towards the end of last year, the new president of Egypt issued a decree giving him almost total power. You know who opposed him? You know who tried to overthrow that law? The judiciary. So you have one district of Egypt against another district. You've got the executive opposed to the judiciary. District against district. It's like reading your newspapers. I believe Isaiah 19 verse 2 is underway. I believe it's already started. And therefore the events that we read on about are going to tumble in the future. They're going to come out one after the other. What's going to happen? Well, in the following verses, just briefly, we read Egypt divided eventually falls to Gog, verse 4, and the Egyptians in their chaotic state, he says, "I will give over into the hand of a cruel lord," read Gog, "and a fierce king shall rule over them." That's the king we read about. The king of the north who comes down upon Egypt in Daniel 11. We'll come to that a little later on. That's the power. Why will this happen? Well, because you see of Egypt's dire poverty, verses 5 to 10, of their political folly. It's going to come about for the very things that we're watching happening right now. So that's just a brief summary of what prophecy requires in relation to Egypt. We could say a whole lot more about that, of course. But you just get a bit of a feel. That's one of many things that are happening. And the Egyptian army chief, this heading of an article in Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, in January the 29th, 2013, said this. "Egyptian army chief warns state could collapse if crisis continues. The head of the Egyptian armed forces has warned that the current political crisis could lead to the collapse of the state." General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who was also defence minister, said the economic, social, and political challenges, you could be reading Isaiah 19, couldn't you? The economic, political challenges that Egypt is facing represent a real threat to the security and cohesiveness of the state. If we can't see Bible prophecy being fulfilled, then we're not reading carefully. That's happening, brethren and sisters and young people. But it's also happening in Syria. Syria, with 100,000 dead and probably about 2 million refugees. people living in all sorts of terrible circumstances. The Arab Spring has destroyed that country. I toured that in 2010. We went all over Syria. Can't go there today. It's an absolute ruin. Why is that happening? Well, it's happening because Bible prophecy requires the Assad regime, which is a sworn enemy of Israel, to be quieted. Bible prophecy requires Israel to be at peace, not only internally so it can take down its walls, but externally. It has to have peace with all of its neighbours so it feels as though it's secure, so it can disarm. That's the requirement prior to Armageddon. So the Syrian regime has got to go too. Hezbollah, sponsored by Syria and Iran, who are ensconced in southern Lebanon, they've got to be dealt with as well. Syria, we're going to find, was part of the Seleucid Kingdom of old, the territory once ruled by one called, in Daniel 11, the King of the North. Okay, so we're going to have a little bit of a look at that, brethren and sisters, and this is probably where we just need to squeeze the thinking cap on a little bit harder, because I know by experience that there are some challenges for some. We'll work our way through it. Russia, you know, is building ties with Israel and has offered to create a Gazprom Israel. Did you hear about that? Putin was there, of course, in June last year. The president of Israel went to Moscow in August last year. There are 1.5 million Russian Jews living in Israel, many of whom have families back in the homeland, what they would call their homeland, Russia. That's why there are strong ties developing between these two countries. And when they found oil and gas, Putin said, well, you know, I rule Gazprom. Yeah, he's the richest man in the world, about $60 billion worth. He runs Gazprom. It's his business. I got Gazprom here. We can create a Gazprom Israel, Israel. Well, they actually knocked him back for the time being. But the time will come, as we're going to see, when there will be some kind of agreement between them. Turkey leads the Arab League against Syria. So that whole area is in confusion. So why is this stuff happening in Syria? And why do the Russians stop any move by the Western nations to get involved in it? Why do they stand in the way of Security Council resolutions that might help resolve that situation? Well, because they have two ports in Syria that they put a lot of money into. They've got the port up here of Latakia, where they want to put most of their Black Sea fleet. They've got the port of Tartus. Now, I actually stood up on the heights about 30 or 40 miles from Tartus in 2010, and you could see all the equipment, the huge cranes and things that were going on. You know how many Russians there are in Syria? 50,000. 50,000 Russians are there because they have got these two ports. Well, why would they want ports? Well, because, you see, Daniel 11 verse 40 says this, the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into countries and shall overflow and pass over. Yes, they'll have the bulk of their Black Sea fleet and much of their Baltic fleet ensconced just to the north of Israel. That's why they're not going to let Syria go, and that's why they're going to actually take Syria over. Brethren and sisters, they're going to have political control of Syria. I can see some strange looks coming. Well, I'm going to show you that that will be the case, scripturally. They will have political control of Syria. These are the prophecies that I believe are about to be fulfilled. Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan and Pakistan, which are the Persia of Ezekiel 38 verse 5. You know, when we read Persia, it doesn't just mean Iran. It means the ancient Persia, the territory of the ancient Persia. That was these countries. Those countries I've just listed off. They're about to fall to Russian control. And we're going to have a look at those two verses in a moment, Daniel 7 verse 7 and Daniel 11 verse 40. We're going to demonstrate that that, in fact, is the case. The second prophecy. Israel will annex the West Bank and deal with Hamas and Hezbollah in order for peace to descend on the Middle East, as required by Ezekiel 38 verses 8 to 12, in preparation for Gog's invasion. And they'll do more than that, brethren and sisters. Because when the Assyrians began to rumble in the north in the past, two kings of Judah made a pact with the Assyrians. One was an evil king with no faith. The other was one of the greatest kings of Judah's history. One was named Ahaz, and the other one was named Hezekiah. And you want to have a look at those records. If you don't believe me, have a look at 2 Kings 16, 7 to 9. I haven't got time to take you back there now. And 2 Kings 18, 13 to 16, they both say basically the same thing. That when the Assyrians threatened to the north, Ahaz and later on Hezekiah stripped the silver and the gold from the temple and sent their ambassadors off to the Assyrians and said, let's have peace. In the case of Hezekiah, the Assyrians said, yes, we'll have peace. And then shortly thereafter came down and attacked the land. And you know what happened? 46 cities of Judah fell, and there remained but three. And there was Hezekiah and his people locked up like birds in a trap in Jerusalem. And the scripture uses that Assyrian invasion as a type of the latter-day Gog's invasion of the land. And in the same way that the 185,000 Assyrians perished outside the walls of Jerusalem, so Gog's host will perish outside the walls of Jerusalem. That's why through all of our prophecies we have the Assyrian mention. Israel, of course, will remain prosperous. We've been talking about that. The latter day Assyrian. Well, here he is. He's in Micah 5 verse 5. And this man, Christ, shall be the peace when the Assyrian shall come into our land, when he will tread in our palaces. Isaiah 14:25, that I will break the Assyrian in my land, says God, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Isaiah 31 verse 8, then shall the Assyrian fall with the sword. You know, there are literally half a dozen prophecies like that in Isaiah. The Assyrian is used throughout the prophecy of Isaiah and in Micah to represent the latter-day Gog coming down upon the land. So history will be repeated. Before they make that move, there will be a peace agreement between Russia and Israel. And I'm going to explain to you why that will be a necessity. What would you do if you were the Israelis and the Russians took political control of Syria next door? And they also had control of Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan and Pakistan. What would you do? Well, you've only got two choices. You either go to war with them or you make an agreement with them. And you know what happened in 1940 when Hitler was flexing his muscles and the Second World War had started? Well, Russia and Germany made an agreement. And you know what Stalin did in the wake of that? He was absolutely confident that the Germans would keep their pact, that they would not break it. So he shot his best generals, who were potentially opposition to his leadership. He was shooting quite a lot of people, actually, in 1938, 1939 and 1940. Okay? So he shot his best generals. And in 1942, Hitler attacked Russia, and he didn't have generals to lead his army. They were in serious trouble. He was so shocked by that, he was not seen in public for 2 weeks. He's the leader of a country that's being attacked. You've got Germans streaming across the country. He didn't appear in public for 2 weeks. He was so shattered. It's going to happen again. But this time, the victim's going to be Israel. Has they come to take a spoil, they say? It's opposition? They don't realise what's going to hit them. Because they will have made a watertight agreement. Well, what they think's watertight. Just like Hezekiah thought he had a watertight agreement with the Assyrians, and it didn't work out to be watertight. That's going to happen. I want to show you the catalyst that will bring that to pass a little later on. But for the time being, we need to deal with this matter of the territory that Russia is going to control as part of its confederacy. And this is a very important verse, Daniel 7 verse 7. So you might want to come along to that chapter, Daniel 7 verse 7. Now, Daniel 7 is quite well known, isn't it? It's got the four beasts that match the four parts of the metallic image of Daniel chapter 2. Daniel 2 is man's perspective of his empires. That's why the figure is of a man. Daniel 7 is God's perspective of man's empires. That's why they're beasts. So here we've got the same thing represented by different imagery. Well, the fourth beast is in verse 7. It's the Roman Empire, of course, it's the subject. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth, there's your identifier, iron, the symbol of Rome. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all those that preceded it, and it had 10 horns. Now there's one part of that verse that remains outstanding, that was never fulfilled in the history of the Roman Empire. It's the words in green on the screen. These words have not been fulfilled. And stamped the residue with the feet of it. I want to explain to you why that hasn't been fulfilled in a moment. But let's just talk a little bit about these four empires and the territories that they occupied, and you'll get an idea of what the residue is of these empires that Rome never conquered. So here's the Assyro-Babylonian Empire, begun by Nimrod. Of course, it reached its height in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. It only lasted for 70 years, but it was massive in terms of those times. But it was rather a small territory, wasn't it? You can see that darkened area there on the wall, the red boundary. That was basically the Empire of Babylon. Now, it was followed in due course by Medo-Persia. Now, that was massive by comparison. It went right over to Macedonia, right over to India. It had the underbelly of Russia in it. And all, of course, this area, including Egypt, were part of the empire of the Medo-Persians. That was followed by the Grecian Empire of Alexander the Great, 334 to 67 BC, and it was a very similar territory. Right over, he began over here in Macedonia, of course, and he went right over to the Indus River. So he had a very similar territory, perhaps not quite so much of the underbelly of Russia, but a very large tract of land. What about the Romans? Well, when the Roman Empire came on the scene, a lot of it was big, but a lot of it was in the west. You know, the Romans did come up to the Persian Gulf under Trajan, but they lost so many men, they even lost an emperor out here trying to protect that territory. The Parthians to the north of them made life so difficult for the Romans that in 118 AD, Hadrian withdrew from Trajan's conquest in the east. And he built a line of forts that run up through modern Jordan and modern Syria. I've been to several of those forts. Every Roman mile, there was a fort. And you can go and stand in the ruins today. That was the easternmost boundary of the Roman Empire. So what do you think the residue of Daniel 7, verse 7 is? Well, it's the territories that Rome never conquered of the previous empires. Well, what territories were they? These ones. Right from Syria, right across to the Indus River, the underbelly of Russia, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan. They're the territories that can be described as the residue. So you see, brothers and sisters, when we read that verse, we know that something has yet to happen. Now let's just establish in our minds what this means. What it means is that there has to be a revival of this fourth beast. In fact, there has to be a revival of all of them. The territories of all of those four beasts have to be embraced into one image empire. And Christ and the saints are going to destroy that revived fourth beast. You have a look at verse 11 of Daniel 7. It says this: "And I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake." This is the horn that comes out of the head of the fourth beast. "I beheld even till the beast," this is the fourth beast, "was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame." So Christ and the saints are going to destroy this fourth beast. You can't destroy it if it's not there. So it has to be rebuilt. And Russia is going to put this empire together. It's going to create the image of Nebuchadnezzar. It's going to take the territories of these four beasts and put it together into one massive image empire. Russia has to have control. It has to have political control of this area from Syria right across to the Indus River. Well, is that the only place that we can suggest that proves this? No, it's not. That's why we read Daniel chapter 11. So just come along a few chapters in our Bible. Daniel 11. So how are you getting on here? Well, I'm going to put a bit more on you. So pull that cap on a bit tighter. All right? Won't be long and we'll get into the easier stuff. Daniel 11 verse 40. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen, with many ships. He shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. And the following verses tell us he goes, his primary aim initially is Egypt. Then he's drawn out of Egypt back to the glorious land, the land of Israel, where he's destroyed. Okay? So the powers of this verse, and there are three of them that we have to identify. The powers of this verse are the king of the south, the king of the north, and a power called him. Push at him. Shall come against him. So we've got to identify who these powers are. Now, it's not too difficult, because if you read Daniel 11, it tells you about the history of the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the north was the territory of Seleucus. You know, when Alexander died, his empire was eventually, after about 20 years, it was eventually divided up amongst his four generals. And two of those four powers that arose out of his empire, they're the four horns of Daniel 8, two of those powers became very significant. The one to the north of Israel was called the King of the North. It was the territory of Seleucus and his successors. It became known as the Seleucid Kingdom. It went from Syria, where he had his capital, to the Indus River. You know, to be called the King of the North, you had to be an occupying power. Not the native power, but an occupying power. The Greeks were an occupying power. Now, what about the king of the south? Well, the name suggests it's to the south of Israel, and so it was. Egypt became the territory of a man called Ptolemy, another general, a prominent general of Alexander the Great. So he ruled Egypt. Now, he was an occupying power, he and his Greeks. So they called that place, or the scripture calls it, the king of the south. So to be called these names, you have to be in occupation, if you're the king of the north, of the Seleucid territory, from Syria to Pakistan. To be called the king of the south, you have to be in occupation of Egypt. All right? Now, is that reasonably clear? And what they did, of course, is that the king of the north and the king of the south fought with each other for dominance in the world. Who's the meat and the sandwich? Well, Israel. They marched across the land of Israel. That's why we've got Daniel chapter 11 in our Bibles. Because Israel was the meat and the sandwich. And out of that came, of course, a lot of significant events in history. Not the least of those, the rise of the Maccabees, who fought Greek control of their land. So that's those two characters. What about this other character, him? Well, him, and I'm going to demonstrate this to you in a moment. That word him refers to the power occupying Constantinople. So just put that one in the back of your mind and we'll tie that up in a minute. Just accept for the time being that that's the case. So let's read this prophecy. The first part of that verse has been fulfilled. When it says, and at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, up to there has been fulfilled. It was fulfilled in 1917. When Britain, which at the time was the occupying power of Egypt, and therefore could be called the king of the south, pushed the Turks from Palestine in the events of the First World War. Using, of course, Australian troops, don't want to boast, Australian troops, well, in fact, cavalry from Beersheba, General Allenby pushed the Turks out of the land of Palestine, and he walked into Jerusalem on the 11th of December 1917. That's simple history. Okay, that was the fulfillment of that prophecy. What about the second part of the verse? Well, the second part awaits fulfillment. And the king of the north, the power occupying the area of the Seleucid Empire, shall come against him. Well, the him, the power occupying Constantinople in 1917 were the Turks. Who's there today? Well, the Turks. So this is about the Russian invasion from the north into Turkey. But you know, that can't happen, brethren and sisters, until the Russians are in control of the territory from Syria to Pakistan, because you can't be called the King of the North until you have that territory. You just can't be called it. So we know the order of events. I want to just demonstrate that to you. Let's just talk about this hymn of Daniel 11, verse 40, first of all. Daniel 11 verses 36 to 39, the preceding four verses, identify who that him is. It's the king of verse 36. That king of verse 36 to 39 is the same power referred to in Daniel 8 verse 9 as the little horn of the goat. It's the Roman Empire in the east, ruled from Constantinople. And of course, during its 1,000-year history, it was in support of the papacy and the Catholic Church. That's who the him is, the power occupying Constantinople. Now, Brother Thomas makes this statement in Helpers Israel, page 403. It's a very important statement. He says this: it matters not whether they be pagan Romans, Catholic Greeks, Muslim Turks, or Greek Catholic Russians, the power that rules in Constantinople and plants its standard in Assyria is the little horn of the Assyro-Macedonian horn of the goat of Daniel chapter 8. Got that? So it doesn't matter who's in possession of Constantinople. When you possess it, you become the little horn of the goat, which is why in Daniel 8, Christ and the saints destroy the power of Gog, because Gog has become, by its possession of Constantinople, the little horn of the goat, the eastern leg of Nebuchadnezzar's image. That was its base. The western leg is based in Rome. Let me just explain that a little bit clearer, I hope. See this green patch here? This is the map of Alexander's kingdom. Here's your king of the south, occupying Egypt. This green area is basically the area of the Seleucid kingdom, the king of the north, of Daniel 11, verse 40, which means that Russia has to control this area in order to be called the king of the north so it can come against the him, the power installed in Constantinople, which today, of course, is the Turkish nation. That is how prophecy will unfold. So Gog has several names in prophecy. It passes through several phases on its way to Armageddon. It's called the King of the North, Daniel 11:40, when the Seleucid territory is controlled. It also, at the same time, because it plants its standard in Assyria, ancient Assyria, it becomes the Assyrian. It's also called, when it controls Constantinople, the little horn of the goat, when it seizes power of that place and of that nation, re-establishes the eastern leg of the empire. And we saw in Isaiah 19 verse 4, it's called a cruel lord. So let me ask you a question. When the Russians take that territory from Syria right across to the Indus River in Pakistan, and you were the Indian Prime Minister, what would you do? Well, I think I know what I would do. I would order my army to go to the other side of the Indus River so that Pakistan, as we know it today, disappears. Gone. Russia's got two-thirds of it. India will have the other third of it. And I would catch the first plane to London to make my peace with the British. I'd go back to my roots. That's what I'd be doing. And that's what's going to happen, I believe. And when it happens, brethren and sisters, we will have an Eastern Tarshish as well as a Western Tarshish. And there was an Eastern Tarshish, wasn't there? Solomon sent ships to Tarshish. They brought back monkeys and all sorts of things. There will be an Eastern Tarshish. You know that India has the largest navy in the Indian Ocean? It's a maritime power. Isn't that interesting? An Eastern Tarshish. Did you know that India has extremely close ties with Israel? Yes. Is that accidental, do you think? Don't think so. Well, there's a lot more, of course, that's going on. Ezekiel 38, verse 13, talks about Britain renewing its ties with its colonies. It talks about Tarshish. We know that you can identify Tarshish with Britain. We won't go into the proofs for that now. Tarshish with all the young lions thereof. Now, this is a First World War poster. The British Empire needs men. Here is the old lion, helped by the young lions. Now, I don't know, how did they come up with that phrase? Helped by the young lions, the old lion of Britain defies his foes. So who are these young lions? Well, Australia, Canada, India, New Zealand. Sorry, US, didn't see your name there. And I don't believe the US is a young lion, by the way, and I can give you proof of that too. Australia, Canada, India, New Zealand. The countries who survived the global financial crisis of 2008 the best were Australia, Canada, India, and New Zealand, together with China and Israel. You reckon that's accidental? Don't think so. And Britain is about to come out of the European Union. Cameron has finally agreed. He's had his arm behind his back in a half Nelson for about 6 years, 7 years, to go to a referendum. The British people want out. They want out of Europe. I want to show you why that referendum will be won by the no vote. It's only going to be a yes or no. Yes, stay in. No, come out. Cameron knows he's going to lose it. So you see, public opinion has swung strongly in favour of withdrawal from the EU. And here is the reason why. I want you to listen to this man, Nigel Farage, leader of the UK Independence Party, who's been in the European Parliament in Strasbourg and, in Belgium. He's been there since 1999, and he's been making addresses like this, and I've got about a dozen of these. This is a bit of a flavour of the way that he is getting up and speaking in the European Parliament. He's elected by the British people to sit in that Parliament. He has a handful of people with him now. He's been re-elected with increasing majorities every time there's an election. He has swung. God has used this man as an instrument to bring Britain out of the European Union. Listen to him.
Mr. Nigel Farage, President of the Europe for Freedom and Democracy.
When we had a president, we'd see a giant global political figure. The man that would be the political leader for 500 million people. The man that would represent all of us on the world stage. The man whose job was so important, but of course you're paid more than President Obama. Well, I'm afraid what we got was you. And I'm sorry, but after that performance earlier that you gave, and I don't want to be rude, but, you know, really, you have the charisma of a damp rag and the appearance of a low-grade bank clerk. And the question that I want to ask, that we're all going to ask is, who are you? I'd never heard of you. Nobody in Europe had ever heard of you. I would like to ask you, President, who voted for you? And what mechanism? Oh, I know democracy's not popular with you lot. And what mechanism do the peoples of Europe have to remove you? Is this European democracy? Well, I sense, though, that you're competent and capable and dangerous. And I have no doubt that it's your intention to be the quiet assassin of European democracy and of the European nation states. You appear to have a loathing for the very concept of the existence of nation states. Perhaps that's because you come from Belgium, which of course is pretty much a non-country. But since you took over, we've seen Greece reduced to nothing more than a protectorate. Sir, you have no legitimacy in this job at all, and I can say with confidence that I can speak on behalf of the majority of the British people in saying, we don't know you, we don't want you, and the sooner you're put out to grass, the better.
Yes, you can see why they get a bit upset with this fellow. He was in a plane accident. They reckon the pilot was hired by someone to kill him off. But he survived because he's gone back and he thrashes the European Parliament with stuff like that. And that's why British opinion, of course, has shifted. Now, I want to conclude tonight, and I know what the time is, so don't worry too much. I've got a few things I want to say. Because what I'm going to say now is about the catalyst that will bring these things to pass that we've been talking about tonight. The catalyst, brethren and sisters and young people, is the impending depression that's about to hit this world. If you haven't seen that coming, then you haven't been reading your newspapers. You haven't been looking. It's coming. And the world knows it's coming. And you know what? We have to be taken away to the judgment seat from a time of prosperity. So ask the question, what will conditions be like in the world just before Christ returns to raise the dead? Will there be poverty and hard times or general prosperity? Well, the answer is suggested by Luke 17, 26 to 30, Luke 21, verse 34, and Revelation 3, 14 to 22. And on Sunday morning in the memorial meeting, God willing, we'll be talking about Laodicea and we'll talk a bit about the prosperity of that time and see who that ecclesia represented in the scheme of things. It was the only letter in which the words, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock," are found. Refers to you and me. Refers to our era. And they were prosperous. And they were in trouble. So that is what I believe the scripture is saying. So why does Christ choose the days of Noah and the days of Lot to represent when he will come? As it was in the days of Noah and the days of Lot, so shall it be in the day of the coming of the Son of Man. Why does he choose that period? Because there was a common denominator. You know, he doesn't even mention anything about violence, which was, of course, happening in the days of Noah. He doesn't mention sodomy, which was happening in the days of Lot. No mention of that. Doesn't mean it wasn't going to happen, but he's not interested in those things. He's only interested in one thing, prosperity. Remember Lot's wife. That was the thing he was interested in. He's telling us something. He's telling us he's going to come to collect us, to take us to the judgment seat, while we are in a time of prosperity. It's been going on now for 70 years. It's about to come to an end with the greatest depression in human history. It's going to make the 1930 depression look like a Sunday school picnic where they forgot to bring the ice creams. Yes, it is. And when you look at what he says, what were they doing? Eating and drinking, marrying and being given in marriage, buying and selling, building and planting. You can only do those things with pockets full of money. You don't do those things in depressions. Go and ask my father, 87 years of age. He'll tell you what they do in depressions, and you don't do those things. He had to wrap canvas around his tyres to run his car because you couldn't buy tyres. So that, brethren and sisters, is telling us something. We're not very far away from the return of Christ. And this depression is going to be the catalyst that will bring about those events we've been talking about. Israel will take unilateral action against its enemies internally and maybe externally because nobody's going to stop them. Nobody's going to have any money to stop them. Nobody's going to have any interest in stopping them. And Russia will do the same to the east and nobody's going to raise a finger against them. It'll be a huge catalyst. But that's going to be happening when you and I are standing at the foot of Horeb waiting for our turn to go before the Lord Jesus Christ. We're not going to see that, I believe. This is evidence of it, because we've got to be taken from times of prosperity. And what happened when Lot was taken out of Sodom? What happened that same day when the sun came up? Those on their way down to the latte shop, the coffee shop, didn't get there. Sodom was blown to smithereens. What about when Noah was put in the ark and the door was slammed shut? A week later, all their prosperity was gone. The morning that we have been taken away to judgment, because we'll go in the evening, by the morning the next day, your neighbours will be lining up against the bank that they've got their money in, trying to get their money out. And they won't care where you are. Not going to be interested. And they'll be there for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks until it becomes obvious and they're not going to get a cent of their money out of the banks. When they come back, there'll be squatters living in your home and they'll probably think that you've probably left anyway. So that's why we read Daniel 11 and 12. You know what it says in Daniel 12, verse 1? Have a look at verse 1. "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even at that same time." You know, what time is this? The time that Michael stands up. Well, it's the time at the end of verse 1 when destinies are sealed. Look at it. "And at that time," in my Bible I've got that phrase highlighted. It occurs twice in the verse. "And at that time." So the time of the resurrection, brethren and sisters, is the time of the beginning of the time of trouble, such as never was. And the chaos that that's going to bring to this society has never been heard of before. Their society will be plunged into the deepest abyss. And they'll be digging themselves out of that for the next 10 years. And they'll just be beginning to think that they're making some progress when Gog will come down upon the mountains of Israel and precipitate the events of Armageddon. And you and I will have been prepared for it. We will have been before the judgment seat of Christ. And our destinies will have been sealed. Now, You don't need me to go through all of this data. You know that the US has just avoided the fiscal cliff and they're now facing another one, the sequestration, whatever it's called. You've heard about that. It's endless, isn't it? So they're facing that right now too. And they've got political gridlock. They can't decide about what they're going to have for lunch, leave alone how they're going to solve the $19 trillion debt crisis that they have in this country. So they're going into the third round of quantitative easing. They call it, of course, printing money. They don't roll the presses. You know what they do? They sit in the Treasury and put a few zeros on the end of their bank balance. Now, that'd be terrific, wouldn't it? If we could go to our bank manager and say, can I put a few zeros on the end of my bank balance? He'd say, get out of here. Because it doesn't work. That lasts about 2 years maximum. And then your currency loses its value and you get hyperinflation and you go down the gurgler. You ain't too far from that. Numerous European states are on the verge of bankruptcy, and it will force amalgamation of states. I believe the outcome of this time of trouble will be 10 nations in Europe that will support the papacy against our Lord Jesus Christ. They've got 27 in the EU today. It's going to come down to 10. China is preparing for the depression by building internal demand for its goods because it knows that the rest of the world's going to stop buying them soon. Canada and Australia, New Zealand, India, Russia and Israel are best placed economically. Accidental? No. There is a convergence of events. And the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, who replaced that other fellow Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who got himself in a tangle in a New York hotel. You remember him? She said this in December 2011. If the international community doesn't work together, the risk from an economic point of view is that of retraction, rising protectionism, isolation. This is exactly the description of what happened in the 1930s and what followed World War II is not something we're looking forward to. Because they know that the end of it is war. And it is going to be a war, isn't it? Now, I've got one more video, and then I'm going to sit down very shortly thereafter. Very short, 4 minutes. Very, very good snippet from many that I could show you. This guy, Richard Duncan, wrote a book last year called The New Depression. Now, what I like about him, I could show you clips from Gerald Celente, from Dr. Doom, Peter Schiff. I could show you clips from Mark Faber, all saying the same thing, that a depression's coming. But this guy's an optimist. He knows there's a depression coming, but he thinks that, you know, we can get another 10 or 15 years or 10 years or so if we do the right thing. So listen to him. He's got some interesting things to say.
We're very happy to be joined now by the author of The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy, Richard Duncan. Richard, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, we'll all be listening up to this one because obviously we've been in several cadences and several mutations of this crisis. Now, what do you think was the prime cause for getting us into this paper money drama, so to speak?
Right. I think in order to understand this crisis, it's necessary to understand the role that credit has played in bringing it about. So when we broke the link between money and gold 40 years ago, this removed all the constraints on credit creation. And afterwards, credit absolutely exploded. In the U.S., it grew from $1 trillion to $50 trillion, 50-fold increase in 43 years. And this explosion of credit created the world we live in. It created very rapid economic growth. It ushered in the age of globalization. But it now seems that credit cannot expand any further because the private sector is incapable of repaying the debt that it has already. And if credit now begins to contract, there is a very real danger that we will collapse into a new Great Depression.
Now, that brings us back to the old discussion we had here with Roger before, that politicians, unfortunately, are scared of recession, never mind depression, and they probably won't implement any kind of policies that gets us back to reason, because one of them would include letting a number of banks fail, etc. So, to put it mildly, what is your conclusion? Where do we go from here?
Right, I think the thing that's driving government policy now is the belief that if they allow credit to contract, that we will have a new Great Depression. Milton Friedman taught Ben Bernanke that the Fed could have prevented the Great Depression if the Fed had prevented the money supply from contracting. But now credit is the new money. And if they don't prevent the credit supply from contracting, then we will have a new depression. So the policy is to ensure that credit continues to expand. And now that's what government debt is doing. The increase in government debt is making total debt grow. Otherwise, we would have already collapsed into a debt deflation death spiral.
This sounds like if you think there should be further credit expansion, that QE 3, 4, 5, 6, and forevermore is going to be happening in the U.S. economy as far out as we can see.
You know, we're in a very unfortunate position to be here on the teetering on the verge of a new Great Depression. But this explosion of credit has created a kind of new economic system. I call it creditism. Now, creditism creates great perils. If it begins to contract, we will collapse. But it also creates tremendous opportunities. And the opportunities we're overlooking. The opportunity is our governments have the ability to borrow massive amounts of money at just 1.5% interest. If they borrow aggressively and invest this in transformative 21st century technologies, they could actually generate enormous investment returns and new technologies that would end this crisis and, in fact, bring about a technological revolution that would improve the well-being of everyone on this planet.
At some stage, the central banks, particularly the good central banks, the Bundesbank, for instance, when it gets its independence back, is going to raise the interest rates and take the credit out. When that happens, we go willy-nilly, and we can't prevent it, into depression. And I think you just simply can defer, but you can't prevent. The depression, and I agree with you, there's going to be a depression. It might start next year, it might start the year after, might start in 5 years' time. But we can't prevent it. And probably, the more you defer it, the worse it's going to be.
Yes.
Well, the thing is, after a four-decade, $50 trillion expansion of credit, if this credit bubble pops, the depression is going to be so severe that I honestly don't think our civilization could survive it. Therefore, that's why I'm proposing such radical solutions. Let's have the government borrow trillions of dollars and invest in renewable energy, in genetic engineering, biotechnology, nanotechnology, create new industries so that trade comes back into balance, new industries that the government could tax, new products like a cancer vaccine that the government could sell to bring down its budget deficit. And in that way, we can keep the credit growing and we can restructure the economy. And even if every last cent of this money is wasted, in a worst-case scenario, at least we would have prevented a depression for another 10 years, and we could have enjoyed this prosperity for another 10 years before our civilization collapses.
What do you reckon his chances are? I think you can see where that's heading, can't you? You can just turn that down. Thanks for us. Timeline of depressions, very quickly. This is what happened in 1929. There was a stock market crash in October. They usually come in October. By 1930, there was a worldwide depression. It took them 10 years to dig themselves out of it, and only then with a war. So if there's another depression very soon, and we know there's a worldwide oil crisis overdue as well, and it plunges the world into a time of trouble such as never was, it will be followed by a war. Exact same pattern all over again. What will that crash trigger? It will force radical and rapid change. Middle East peace will be achieved at last. Most nations will abandon their overseas adventures, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc., allowing Russian expansionism. An elite group of 10 nations in Europe will emerge, and Israel will remain prosperous on the back of huge finds of oil and gas, all in accordance with Bible prophecy. Brothers and sisters and young people, the world has endured a number of birth pangs. Mothers in this room will know that the birth pangs, when they start, can be spaced out a little. But they gradually intensify and the space between them narrows. That's been happening for the last 20 years. We're now getting them in quick bursts, aren't we? We're about to see a birth. But ye brethren, you don't need to be told about the signs and the times and the seasons. The times, of course, has to do with numbers, years, the seasons, the character of those times. For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. Shouldn't catch us as a thief, should it? And when they all say peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. There's one thing you can't hold back. when those birth pangs start, there is going to be a birth. And it won't be long. And the birth of the kingdom of God will take place. What would you say to all that? I know what I say. I echo the words of John. Even so, come, Lord Jesus.
Thank you very much, Brother Jim. Christ is certainly on his way. We will end now with a prayer.